Here and now, as President Bush arrives today in Jordan to meet with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, the powerful Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has made good on his promise to pull his support of the Iraqi government if Maliki meets with the president. Already, 30 lawmakers and 5 cabinet members of the powerful Dawah party are out of the government boycotting. We'll have more on the role of Sadr and the meaning of the pull of support in a moment. But first, the New York Times has obtained a classified memo written earlier this month by U.S. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, expressing serious doubts about whether Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki is up to the job of quelling the sectarian violence in Iraq and building a stable government. The memo reads, "The reality on the streets of Baghdad suggests Maliki is either ignorant of what is going on or misrepresenting his intentions, or that his capabilities are not yet sufficient." We turn now to Washington Post diplomatic correspondent Robin Wright. Robin, welcome.
Thank you.
And the information in this memo would seem to add to an article that you wrote today that increasingly the blame for Iraq's deterioration is being placed on the Iraqis. Tim Russert said on the Today Show this morning that it's like a switch flipping after the midterm elections. Your sense of, you know, how the memo adds to that feeling that there's a shift going on?
I think it goes on at a couple of different levels. The Bush administration has been increasingly concerned about the performance of Prime Minister Maliki and his ability to tackle the two biggest issues. One is reining in the militias, who are gaining ever more powerful support on the ground, and secondly, reconciliations with the Sunni minority. These are the two critical elements in stabilizing Iraq. It's interesting how the focus of the military campaign has shifted as well from the insurgents and the foreign fighters who have engaged in so much of the deepest violence, the suicide bombings and so forth, to increasingly the sectarian divide among Iraqis, including some who are participants in this government. Now, I think there's a fear that in the administration that Prime Minister Maliki is symptomatic of the broader challenge of getting Iraqis to assume control of their own matters in any form.
And yet the Bush administration points out the memo does not say their interest in replacing al-Maliki, but the criticism is pretty intense. I'll just read one paragraph. There are reports of non-delivery of services to Sunni areas. Of course, al-Maliki is a Shia. Intervention by the Prime Minister's office to stop military action against Shia targets and to encourage them against Sunni ones. Removal of Iraq's most effective commanders on a sectarian basis. All suggest a campaign to consolidate Shia power in Baghdad. Not good news.
No, this is a time of real concern because the Shiite militia has gained very powerful support on the ground, estimated to have up to 60,000 armed fighters that it could call on at any given time. It controls much of Baghdad as well. So this is a powerful force, and it's also been essential to the support of Prime Minister Maliki, his claim to power, because he had the backing of this militia. So its walkout today from his government carries serious repercussions if it lasts. Mm-hmm. It may be a temporary boycott. This is what we don't know yet.
We're going to talk more about that in a moment. But what do you think about the timing of this memo? Just talking the politics for a moment. Stephen Hadley gathered this information in October. The memo was written November 8th. And yet in the run-up to the midterm elections, President Bush gave no inkling of this concern, you know, as he, you know, kind of crossed the country campaigning. What do you think about the timing of its leaking now?
Well, the timing clearly doesn't play well to the administration's meeting today with the Iraqi leadership. But I will say I was on a trip with the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, last month, and it was clear then that one of the things she wanted to talk about was the need for Iraqis to take greater control, both of security and the political realities. The, you know, important part of brokering deals with the Sunni minority, and that the U.S. was concerned back then, which is end of September, early October, about this disintegration, the fact that the government had taken 5 months to be pulled together, and that happened in May, and since then there had not been any major progress on the amending the Constitution to deal with Sunni concerns and bringing them more into the government at a lot of different levels, including the military.
You write of that, as you say, turning point or tipping point back in October, that Condoleezza Rice was uncharacteristically blunt and said things like, our role is not to resolve issues for them, security issues and so forth. They're going to have to resolve those issues among themselves. I mean, that would have seemed to be the beginning of this kind of, not backing away, but a more forceful tone.
I think you see it reflected both in Rice's visit to Baghdad, as well as the statement by Senator John Warner, a very powerful, thoughtful Republican on the Armed Services Committee, who said we should give them 90 days to, you know, and then kind of review what we're doing. And I think that there were powerful signals, and the subsequent trip by Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, to Baghdad, there's been a series of messages to the Iraqis. And I think one of the reasons the president is meeting with him today is that the Iraqis have done nothing in that period to resolve U.S. concerns. There is a sense of a kind of diplomatic panic about what do we do to try to salvage anything out of Iraq and stabilize it within the next 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, sometime soon.
Especially with the new use of the phrase civil war, increasingly Americans are asking the same thing. What do we do and what are we doing there?
Oh, I think that's true. And I think that you find this this permeates all of those people involved in Iraq in any form, be it the troops on the ground, Congress, which provides the funds, policymakers, and it's almost no one who doesn't express concern about what do we do? What do we do?
Robin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Washington Post diplomatic correspondent Robin Wright. Well, we mentioned Iraqi lawmakers and cabinet members loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. In fact, they're called Sadrists. Are boycotting the government today to protest President Bush's meeting with Prime Minister Maliki. Now, we've spoken of Sadr before, but a recent article in Newsweek, in fact, this week's cover story, says the son of a revered Shiite leader once dismissed by American officials as a lightweight rabble-rouser and a punk flying on his father's coattails has grown in power. In fact, on the cover this week, Newsweek calls Muqtada al-Sadr the most dangerous man in Iraq. The younger al-Sadr now rules over a ruthless militia of up to 60,000 armed men and controls a significant block of seats in parliament. So we want to spend a few minutes today on Muqtada al-Sadr. Joining us to do that is Michael Hirsch, senior editor for Newsweek magazine, a contributor to this week's story. And Mike, you call the story of the U.S. confrontation with al-Sadr the story of American folly in Iraq. Why?
Well, from the very beginning of the invasion, there were opportunities to take down or neutralize Sadr very quickly. Early April of 2003, just weeks after the invasion, he was implicated in the assassination of a rival Shiite cleric, Abdelmajid Alcoy, who was, one of the ones the Americans were bringing into the country. And an Iraqi investigating judge, in fact, the same judge who later investigated Saddam Hussein, came to the occupation authorities and said, look, we've got a good case on this guy. Let's issue an arrest warrant. They did. But the American military decided it just didn't want to arrest him. There was fear that there would be widespread protests among Shia because there had been protests in 1999 after Sadr's father had been assassinated by Saddam. And so they just missed several opportunities.
I just want to stop you there, Michael, because as you write, they also missed an opportunity way before this to understand the nature of Sadr's role, because as you write, his father was assassinated. He himself was treated brutally by Saddam's men. To his credit, he wouldn't take hush money.
Right.
He would have seemed to have been a friend of the U.S. going in, and yet the U.S. aligned itself with some of the exiles like Chalabi and the Iraqi you just mentioned, who it suspected was killed by Sadr, you know, seeming to not understand the sides.
No, I mean, that's exactly right. A lot of this, as was the whole case for the war, as we the U.S. was misled by these Iraqi exiles, principally Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, who had not lived in the country for decades, who purported to understand it but really did not, gave the Bush administration this vision that must be now seen as fantastical in retrospect, that they could create a secular democracy, a model in the Middle East, rather than having to deal with the real power centers who turned out to be some of these religious factions and parties. And so, not just Sadr, but even moderate clerics who were a stabilizing force, like Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, were marginalized in the early days. And course, you know, the irony is that that now Iraq has become very Islamicized.
Well, and paint a little more of a picture of his power right now. You liken him to a mafia don. You tell stories from U.S. soldiers who say they know when Sadr's men are nearby.
Yeah, you know, one of the big problems the U.S. is having now is that the forces we're trying to set up, the army and the police, particularly the police, are infiltrated by Sadrists and members of other militia. And you can see them. The soldiers, you know, tell us that, you know, you can see who the Sadrists are. And we've had some of these incidents where police have even turned on U.S. soldiers and killed them. And that's extremely dangerous.
You quote U.S. troops saying you can see, they can see it in their eyes. They know when someone's looking at them and saying, I'm going to kill you, and it's maybe a policeman they're trying to train.
Right, right. And look, I mean, this is a guy who was virulently anti-American from the very start, set himself apart that way, was also seen as a champion of the Shiite underclass. You know, the Shiites were always the sort of downtrodden in Iraq. And history has more or less gone his way. I mean, the U.S. occupation has become less and less popular. Americans have become less and less popular. And Sadr has become more popular as that has occurred. So there's no great mystery.
And Thomas Friedman reminds us that the Shiites were, in some ways, very patient after the invasion, while Saddam's former men, the Baathists and the Sunnis, were the ones waging the attacks.
Oh, unquestionably. I mean, for the first couple of years of the occupation, the Sunni insurgents were killing them in great numbers, particularly led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the foreign jihadi who was there. And under the advice of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the Shiites were restrained. I mean, it was quite notable. But at some point there was a tipping point, perhaps when the Samarra Mosque was bombed in February. Which was very holy to the Shiites, and many Shiites said enough is enough, and they turned to a guy who was a kick in the door guy, Sadr, rather than someone who's counseling restraint.
Well, he wouldn't have seemed always to be the one they might turn to. In about a minute we have, tell us more about what he used to be. I mean, he was dismissed by Iraqis as Mullah Atari because he liked video games. He inherited a lot of his father's following and mosques and such.
Yeah. Well, it's not unlike in an odd way the story of George W. Bush. I mean, someone who succeeded on the tide of a lot of family prestige and not very much accomplishment on his own. I mean, at the time his father was assassinated in '99, two of his brothers were also killed, and he was seen as a nobody. He was on no one's radar screen at the beginning of the invasion because he was young and not particularly highly regarded, especially as a cleric. But he's turned out to be a very talented politician at this moment in history, particularly based on his anti-Americanism.
Well, one would think so. His standing militia, the Mahdi Army, his militia now numbers 40 to 60,000 armed men. We're going to find out more from Michael Hirsch, senior editor for Newsweek magazine, how that happened. More on Muqtada al-Sadr, the man Newsweek and many others are calling the most dangerous man in Iraq at this moment, and the one who seems to be able to pull politicians from parliament just at his command. Much more when we come back here and now. We're back with Michael Hirsch, senior editor for Newsweek magazine, a contributor to this week's cover story on Muqtada al-Sadr, the leading Shia, or one of the leading Shia clerics in Iraq. Mike, you and your co-authors paint an incredible picture of an Iraq in which Muqtada al-Sadr really runs the show. I mean, using children and young men as lookouts, GIs tell of, getting out of their Humvees, and they'll see a kite or a flock of pigeons, and they know that it's one of Sadr's people, maybe a child, releasing pigeons to tell snipers where they are. An incredible picture of how he runs the country, or at least parts of it.
Yeah, well, again, I think you want to go back to the mafia analogy, which, interestingly enough, was often used about Saddam's reign, that such a fractious and hateful-filled place, you needed someone of that level, a sort of Don Corleone type. And Sadr and his group have been very savvy, not just in rabble-rousing, but also in somewhat on the model, not just of the mafia, but also Hezbollah in Lebanon, providing services in some of these poor neighborhoods, filling the power vacuum, as it will, just security and first aid and medical care. and very, you know, taking over critical ministries like health and transportation and using those as power bases to the point, you know, where they're even supplying propane to people. Very smart.
Well, I was going to say, New York Times reporting this week that Hezbollah might be training some of the troops, but he has also said he's not just anti-American, he's anti-any or most outside interference.
Yeah.
And what, you know, Iran, for instance, what do you think happens now? Here he has pulled his, some of his followers have walked out of government today in protest of President Bush meeting with Maliki. We have this leaked memo expressing dissatisfaction with Maliki as a leader. This is the memo written by the State Department, leaked to the New York Times last night.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a chance that Muqtada al-Sadr could emerge as the George Washington of Iraq, the one who led a rebellion and ultimately becomes the leader, or will he he'll be removed?
Well, you know, we don't know. I mean, if he's going to be George Washington, it's going to be in a black turban and presiding over a, sort of a mini, you know, an Iraq that's become like Iran, Islamicized. I mean, what we do know about his group is, you know, they genuinely believe in an Islamicized Iraq. They cast out anyone who is not seen as appropriately devout when they move into a town or a neighborhood. So that is the future if indeed Sadr, you know, is, ever becomes powerful enough to take over. I mean, right now, he has been mainly powerful as a kingpin and as a spoiler. And we're going to, you know, it's very odd, actually, that Bush is meeting with Maliki in Jordan, because Sadr's people had threatened to leave his coalition if Maliki did. And one can only think that perhaps the Bush administration was trying to divide Sadr from Maliki to actually topple the government, yep, which is a very, very dangerous way to go about things.
Do you think it's a bluff on the part of the Sadrists? Not just a, not a bluff, but that it may not last long?
I think it's possible, but in return, you know, they may get a quiet agreement from Maliki that, you know, that he will continue not to crack down on them too hard, which has been one of the big problems the Bush administration has had with Maliki's stewardship, is that, you know, the Sadrists have had sort of free reign. I think that that would be the price of the Sadrists continuing to support Maliki. You know, I think Bush has put Maliki in a very, very difficult position just by asking him to meet him in Jordan.
Yeah. And what about the option of removing Muqtada al-Sadr? You quote Professor Vali Nasser, who's a guest on this program as well, that if you get rid of Sadr, you create 30 different movements.
Yeah, you know, I think at this point it has to be said that he's probably much too powerful. There would be, you know, even more widespread outrage against the Americans by the Shia than you have now, and then you would have the phenomenon of a lot of these radical elements, death squads, you know, operating more on their own, getting their own leaders, and then you really have a failed state situation. I mean, there is no good solution. It's not good with him there, and it would be just as ugly without him.
Is there anything that can be done about the Mahdi army as well? You know, not separately from Sadr, but, you know, the fact that they have taken control of gas stations. I mean, you know, they're getting their funding from somewhere, and it seems to have been, you know, infiltrating all the bloodlines of Iraq. Is there any way to cut that?
Not in the immediate future. I think the only solution, long, you know, is a long-term one where you continue to try to build up a central army. You try to, you know, create a nominally effective central government so that Iraq doesn't break up, and very gradually you try to bring the Mahdi army types into the government and eliminate the more radical elements of them. But we're talking about something that's going to take years, and that's why I think the debate in Washington about, you know, cut and run or stay the course, it's just, it does not reflect reality. I mean, this is just going to be an ugly quagmire that we're going to have to manage for a long time to come.
There's that word. Well, and just
no,
you know,
question.
To put a final point on it, I mean, you're right, it's a real conundrum. The longer the U.S. stays in Iraq, the more powerful Sadr grows. But is the opposite true? If the U.S. were to leave immediately, would that remove the basis of his support?
Well, certainly it might remove some of it. But I think if you could say, you know, if you imagine the U.S. were to leave Iraq tomorrow, I think one of the first things that would happen would be that a lot of the politicians working with the current Iraqi government, the U.S.-sponsored Iraqi government, would be killed along with their families. And then you would have a real failed state situation in which al-Qaeda could rise. So there's just, you know, that's not a it's not a viable solution.
Well, and just on that, in the minute or so we have, just that last note, al-Qaeda, how close is Sadr with al-Qaeda? He's rejected, or not rejected, distanced himself from Iran, said he doesn't want outside interference. What about al-Qaeda?
Well, no, I mean, he's a Shiite, and al-Qaeda, you know, is Sunni. And in fact, one of the great legacies, terrible legacies, that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Sunni, the Jordanian Sunni terrorist, left was this sectarian warfare. He targeted the Shiites in great numbers, mm-hmm. killed them, and that's what led directly to Sadr and these death squad militias arising.
Right. So ironies abound. He is an enemy of al-Qaeda in Iraq and an enemy of the U.S. as well.
Exactly.
Michael Hirst, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, contributed to this week's terrific cover story on Muqtada al-Sadr. It labels al-Sadr the most dangerous man in Iraq. Michael, thanks for speaking with us about it.
Thanks for having me.
And when we come back, how public universities are maybe not doing their job. And then later, the Canterbury Tales, as the rappers might tell them. More coming up here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
And now, are the top public universities becoming richer and whiter? Many of them are, according to a new report by the Education Trust. Now, these flagship state universities, the cream of the crop, according to the Education Trust, are becoming less accessible to low-income students and minority students. As a result, the report found university student populations are becoming less representative of the states they're meant to serve. In Georgia, for example, the numbers show that while minorities make up 35% of public high school graduates, less than 7% go on to the University of Georgia. Now, many factors contribute, including earlier this month in Michigan, voters approved a ban on race-based admissions in public education. But there's something else going on. According to Katie Haycock, director of the Education Trust and co-author of the report, Katie, walk us through this. What did you ask when you did this report?
The question we asked was, to what extent do these institutions represent in their undergraduate populations the kind of full ethnic and economic diversity of their states? After all, these universities are public institutions that were created really to provide opportunities for high-achieving kids of all family backgrounds.
And also created to ensure that people would stay and live in the state and become the leading figures in the state.
Exactly. These universities have kind of special responsibility for producing the kind of leadership of a state, the business leaders, the academic leaders, the political leaders. And while they certainly don't produce all of them, they do produce a substantial share.
So what overall did you find?
Well, on the whole, we found that most of these universities have a declining number of low-income and minority students in their freshman class.
You had a way of putting it. You said public universities are getting whiter and richer while high school graduating classes are getting more diverse.
That's exactly right. And I think most Americans know that in virtually every state, we're seeing a real upsurge in the number of students of color in our high schools, graduating from our high schools, even at the highest achievement levels. And the same is true with low-income kids whose high schools are now working hard to prepare them for college, so we're seeing some college preparation rates going up. You would expect, therefore, to see some improvements in the number of minority and low-income students in these institutions, but in fact, we found just the opposite.
This is the same thing we're hearing about colleges in general, not just state schools. We spoke with author Dan Golden, who said that all colleges now are looking for wealthier students. In fact, some of them call these kids development cases, you know,
yes,
because they'll bring in money. And this is, you know, at the expense of qualified students who don't have that potential for being donors down the road.
Exactly. Dan's book, The Price of Admission, really focused on this practice at the most elite institutions. But what we looked at was what you would call the sort of public Ivies, right? And unfortunately, we found much the same pattern that he documented in the private institutions.
Why do you think this is happening?
Well, part of it is it's a part of a broader social phenomenon in the U.S. where kids growing up in privileged families go to more and more privileged schools. As more and more of them sort of compete to go on to more elite universities, these elite universities can essentially ride that wave up. And if they ride that wave up, they essentially get not just alumni who will be more likely to be donors, but they work their way up in the college ranking systems, which unfortunately have very little to do with the quality of what you do, more really of with sort of who you keep out of your institutions.
Why are these public colleges feeling that they have to compete with elite private schools, because that's not what they were set up for.
It isn't what they were set up for, but it's, you know, it's a bit of what we've become as, you know, we've become this kind of privilege, you know, racking up more points, society. And these institutions are essentially doing the same thing.
And they are subsidized by taxpayers.
They are, by all taxpayers, not just the well-to-do ones whose kids are going there. And again, there are problems here not just with these institutions. I want to be clear about that. Federal government has pushed more and more of its money away from the most needy students toward more affluent students. State governments more and more are pushing state student aid dollars, not toward the poorest students.
Give us an example of how the numbers have changed for minority or low-income students and students from, let's say, middle-class families.
Basically, if you look at student financial aid for students from families below $20,000 a year in our most elite public universities, that actually declined over the last 8 years. At the same time, it actually increased from $50 million spent on students from families above $100,000 a year to $257 million spent on students from families above $100,000 a year in just 8 years. So our priorities are really shifting.
186% increase for students with families with $100,000 or more. Now, families that are struggling, there are families struggling with $100,000 to send kids to school, you know, for $30,000, $40,000 a year.
But remember, these public universities, you're talking about tuitions on average $12,000 to $15,000. And sure, again, college costs are a challenge for a lot of families. And we're certainly not arguing that middle-class families don't need help to send their kids to college. What we do want to question, and I think most Americans would, is, but don't we, before we spend money on the rich, don't we want to make sure that the needs of hardworking, high-achieving, low-income families and kids are met?
What do you say to people, though, who say, again, this is such a charged topic, who say that it should be an even playing field, that if they have kids who are better qualified, have better grades, then they should get financial help or should get a slot at a college before a low-income, low-grade student?
Let me respond to that in two ways. First, the data are overwhelmingly clear that there are significant numbers of very high-achieving low-income students. And I don't mean just test scores, but I'm talking about taking all the right courses in high school, taking and completing AP classes and the like. And those students are going to these selective universities at only about one quarter the rate of similar achieving high-income kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, you don't have to lower your standards to get more low-income students in. You might have to work a little harder to find them because they're not congregated in fancy suburban schools, but they are there.
And they do need financial help.
They absolutely need financial aid. Without financial aid, they can't go to college. For others, it's nice and it's helpful, but for them, it's essential. The second thing, though, I want to say is there's no such thing as an even playing field in this country for low-income kids from birth on, frankly. What we do in education, it doesn't even come close to providing an even playing field for these kids. They enter behind, but rather than give them what they need to catch up, we put them in schools with the least well-educated teachers, with the lowest level of curriculum, with the lowest standards for their education. And then, even then, when they manage to get through with high achievement, we don't help them go to college.
Katie Haycock, director of the Education Trust. For more on their report on equity in the flagship state universities, go to our website, here-now.org. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead and staying with schools, Chaucer must be the bus driver because he's taking some kids to school. The Canterbury Tales goes hip-hop. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, for those of you who don't spend enough time glued to your cell phone, Boston University and a mobile phone company are collaborating on a new course. It's called Experimental TV, and it's about producing for the very small screen. Here now is Andrea Shea, dropped in on the class where students are making little films for little mobile phones.
It's called Experimental TV, but this afternoon's class gets off to a rather conventional start.
So we're going to do some auditioning, and we're going to go over our script stuff from last time.
Papers scatter across a table littered with laptops. The 11 students sitting around it have a lot to accomplish by the end of the semester. Instructor Jan Eagleson explains.
What we've set out for ourselves is to do 10 three-minute films that are interlinked by character. And the model is really telenovelas. So somebody suggests in the class, oh, we'll call them selenovelas.
They're also being called mobisodes or mobilettes because the mini films are being shot and viewed with shiny black phones supplied by Amped Mobile. Ultimately, the cell phone company will distribute the content via its cell phone TV network. It's one of a few providers that already make existing TV shows available to customers, but Amped is the only company producing original narrative content for its cell phones. This is new territory for everyone involved, especially course instructor Eagleson, who's been making movies the old-fashioned way for almost 30 years. When BU first asked Eagleson to teach the new course, he says his head popped with questions.
Oh my God, can you do this? What do cell phones do? Technically, what do they do aesthetically? What are the rules?
Rule number one might be...
You don't want to do Lawrence of Arabia on a cell phone. You know, you're probably not going to pull that off. But doing intimate, intense moments between characters, it's very good at, actually.
I actually wrote a screenplay over the summer. It's about this girl.
There usually is.
But the problem is she won't really let him in.
But somehow he gets to her and then they live happily ever after.
Well... Not exactly.
This short demo features a college-aged girl and a college-aged guy. 18 to 24-year-olds are the target demographic for the cell phone shorts. Looking at the content on the tiny screen, Eagleson says the class is starting to get a feel for what doesn't work in this medium and what does.
Close-ups work well. Little camera movements work well. Short shots work well. Bright colors work very well, identifying people by color and costume. So we're learning a lot of little tricks.
The students and teachers are also learning the limitations of cell phones as film gear.
Press the down
button.
Yeah.
Press the down button.
Okay,
here we go. Are we ready?
Yep.
Okay, ready and action. Wait for the... And... Action. Here we go.
The cell phone cameras only record 15 seconds at a time. This means the action starts and stops a lot.
It's the QB's fault.
Now we're done.
Okay, so we're going to pick it up right there. It's the quarterback's fault. Okay, are we ready?
Ready.
Got it rolling. And action.
It's the QB's fault.
The scene fragments are eventually pieced together, like all movies and TV shows, in the editing room. But will it hit? Will people actually watch these telenovelas on the go?
I'm very, very skeptical.
Chuck Schaffler is the executive vice president at FX Networks. He's also a BU alum.
I think that there's reason why we like our living rooms and our TV sets or our computers, however we get this content, because that's where we can provide the focus for narrative storytelling.
The idea of focus looms large in filmmaker Jan Eagleson's mind. In class, he and his students share theories on the power of sound.
That's a big advantage because...
Senior Doug Shineman hopes to find work as a traditional filmmaker after he graduates, but says if he never makes a movie with a cell phone again, the experiment so far has been worth it.
It's just something that we're trying out and seeing where it goes and learning what works and what doesn't work and enjoying the process of being the first people to figure out how this can actually be done.
And for right now at least, original content created by and for cell phones is only being done in this classroom, 15 seconds at a time.
Here now is Andrea Shea. And by the way, the Sundance Institute says it will release cell films from 5 indie directors in February. So someone's behind it. Stay with us. Snoop Dogg Chaucer still ahead here and now. Here and Now, and we have a few quick thoughts before our Snoop Dogg Chaucer. First, this correction. Last week, in speaking of the late Robert Kennedy, we referred to him as the senator from Massachusetts. Our deep apologies. We've grown accustomed to saying Kennedy, senator from Massachusetts. But of course, as many of you wrote to say, Robert Kennedy was senator from New York. A few other thoughts from the Here and Now mailbag. We heard from many of you after our Thanksgiving Day conversation with Rose Styron, the widow of William Styron, author of Sophie's Choice and other classics. We talked, among other things, about his depression and whether it formed his work or was caused by it. Well, Charlie Lowmiller of Sharon, Massachusetts, writes, "All I can think to say is thank you, you, Rose, and William, for a moving piece. And we can also be thankful for Mr. Styron and the view he gave us of the human experience. The darkness of his depression was a high price to pay, but I'm grateful for the gifts he left us." Well, we also spoke recently with Barbara Chow of the National Geographic Geography Bee about the lack of awareness of geography. We heard some of the bee questions as well, and Virginia Sykes writes, "Questions such as, where is the tiny, tingy-tangy tutu frog found, seem pretty irrelevant to a population that can't even find New York on a map. Geography, yes, but let's start with, can you identify the United States?" And finally, a segment we did on dot-com millionaire Mickey Singh, who put his money in his band Dragonfly, brought this from Jeffrey Stewart Newton from Detroit, Michigan. "I'm a virtuoso jazz saxophonist. I've played since 1973. I practice my horn 8 to 15 hours a day, every day for years. I've sat in with Branford Marsalis' band. Let's face it, Mickey Singh wouldn't be anywhere in music or on your show without his money." Well, we called Jeffrey up and said, "Bring it on," and he did. Here's his music, Congo Blue. Send us your music, who knows, or your thoughts at letters@here-now.org, or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Don't forget your name and town. Pretty good, Jeffrey. Well, Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales are one of the great literary masterpieces of the English language, but he wrote them in the 14th century when Middle English was the language of the day, and that means the stories aren't always accessible to today's audiences. Well, Here Now's Nina Mitchell caught up with a modern-day teller of these tales who hopes to change that.
"One that April, with his surest sorter, the drought of March hath persed to the rota. And bothered every vine."
Do you remember the first lines of the Canterbury Tales you had to memorize in eighth grade? No? Well, here's the skinny. Chaucer tells the story of 31 people who are on a pilgrimage to Canterbury, England. To pass the time, they tell stories, and it's a perfect plot device because the characters are from all strata of society and all levels of bodiness. The problem is, it can be hard for modern audiences to understand the language of the 1300s.
"And palmeres for to saken stranger strandes to ferna halwes hooth in sundry landes."
Hear what I mean? Enter Baba Brinkman.
"It was April. You know, when those sweet rain showers come and soak all the roots of the plants that are dried out from the drought of March, and this causes flowers..."
Brinkman is 28, a skinny blonde white guy from Vancouver. His clothes aren't bling, but he loves hip-hop, and he has a master's degree in medieval literature. From those two passions, he has developed a rap show based on the Canterbury Tales. In Brinkman's version, the journey is not taken by pilgrims, but rap artists on a bus after a concert. To pass the time, they try to out-rap each other.
"He goes, now we got a couple hours to kill between this town and the next town, so what I'm thinking is, we can't just be chilling. We gotta keep our skills sharp. So what I'm thinking is, we gonna have us a battle right now between all y'all rappers to help pass the time along the way, like an 8 Mile, right? But this time ain't gonna..."
For Brinkman, what began as a class assignment is now a living. He gets invites from high schools, colleges, bars, and coffee houses to perform his Chaucer rap. We caught up with Brinkman at Wellesley College outside Boston. So why Chaucer?
Well, I think Chaucer through prescience or through some coincidence, managed to anticipate hip-hop culture in the Canterbury Tales. It's an extreme statement, but the Canterbury Tales is based around competition between rhyming narrative verses, and that's exactly what I see rap as being, so I wrote my thesis about connecting rap and Chaucer, and then I started rewriting the tales, and it just worked so well, and people reacting to it so well that I just kept going with it.
The Pardoner's Tale. Greed is the root of all evil. My story begins at a bar where three friends drink cheap gin and party hard all weekend. These men were riot starter types who spent the better part of their money on cards and dice, living the life of...
Chaucer is the greatest English poet, even better than Shakespeare.
The woman behind that controversial statement is Wellesley Professor of Medieval Literature, Catherine Lynch. She brought Brinkman to campus as a way to highlight Chaucer's accomplishments.
Iambic pentameter, the rhyming couplet, really in some ways the novel, Troilus and Cressida, has been called the first novel in the English language, even though it's in verse. I'm very grateful for this performance because it reminds people that everything's always about Shakespeare and there's a lot more to be done with Chaucer.
Brinkman says the academics who invite him to perform are trying to get their students interested in Chaucer, and rap certainly wakes them up.
People watch the show and they think, oh wow, I never thought of rap like that. I always thought it was just, you know, misogynist pimp music on the radio. But actually, it can be insightful.
I think he really captured that well, and in his rap version, all the important points are still there. They're just updated in a much more entertaining version than whenever I did in high school.
Rebecca Kays is a senior at Wellesley. She is a Chaucer fan who says his words are relevant to modern society. For example, take the Wife of Bath, about a knight who finds true happiness when he lets his wife rule.
When we hear today, she says, what do women want most of all? And the answer in her tale is they just want to have power over the men of their lives, tell other men what to do. And I think in Chaucer's day, they laughed at that. And today, we're still laughing at that. It's still a good joke. And it's still something that women want in their relationships, and perhaps men don't want to give in their relationships.
You decide. And as soon as the knight let his wife get control of his life and truly decided to let go, the next moment she changed from a gray, decrepit old creature to a young lady with such incredible features, the knight was speechless and stood in a trance, more deeply enchanted each time he took
As for Brinkman, he's got big plans. He might write a rap Broadway musical, or he may develop shows from other great literature, like The Odyssey and Gilgamesh. In the meantime, he's touring the world. Such is the life of a traveling storyteller on his own artistic pilgrimage.
Back in the days of the Dark Ages, when King Arthur made his mark, and courageous knights with tight young pages embarked on outrageous quests and fought for ladies' hearts, the shady parts among the hills...
Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Here now, producer Nina Mitchell had that story. To hear more rapping Chaucer from Baba Brinkman, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
And purged us to cleanse us of our primal urges, to try and discourage us from growing tense. The hills were filled with holy men, and now women could lie alone, content without the old incubi, only them. And so it went that from King Arthur's court, a strong young warrior marched his horse, and through the woods he charted his course, and he met a young girl in the heart of the forest. And with heartless force, in less than a minute, he committed an act of criminal obscenity, and since there was no one else in the vicinity, no one prevented him from taking her virginity. This sinister deed was so repugnant that the knight was thrown in the castle dungeon.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.